Hello, I'm Robert Bounds, and this is The Big Interview, our one-on-one programme that presents the life and work of some of the most fascinating characters in the world, from art and culture to politics and business. How do you do what you do, and why? We're aiming to find out what makes people tick. Today, I'm talking to William Kentridge, the South African visual artist whose poetic, witty and literary work across drawing, sculpture, printmaking, film and theatre and opera design make him a regular Renaissance man. As regular as they are, anyway. And with William Kentridge, the artist is present. He's often in his own work, playing a guy that looks a lot like William Kentridge, but is often an alter ego, allowing him to inspect South Africa's history and politics at an artistic arm's length, perhaps. Kentridge's family were certainly interested in it too. William's father was a lawyer who defended Nelson Mandela and was involved in the inquest into the death of Steve Biko. Kentridge, of Lithuanian Jewish stock, describes himself simply as African. William Kentridge was born in Johannesburg in 1955, and Kentridge first studied politics and African studies at the University at Witwatersrand in Johannesburg before studying fine art at Johannesburg Art Foundation. And for the best part of 40 years, he's exhibited extensively all over the world. At the moment, a survey show, Thick Time, is on at London's Whitechapel Gallery until the 15th of January 2017. And the Whitechapel Gallery is where we're talking today. Downstairs in the Whitechapel, we see all sorts of things that I think start with drawings. Drawings are what you do, is how your mind ticks over, it seems to me. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about the beginning of everything, how you feel maybe more comfortable with a pencil in your hand or a piece of charcoal than anything else.
The projects do all start with drawing, even though many of them end up with using an actor rather than a piece of charcoal. They start usually with drawing, which is to say walking around the room, a physical anxiety about what is it that should be made. And they're like drawings in the sense that when you start a drawing, there may be a first impulse behind it, but it takes the activity of making the drawing, the physical actual making of the drawing, filling the paper with its marks, for the drawing to find out what it is. Yes. It's not as if you plan, have the whole drawing in your head, and then you simply execute it. The activity of making it is the activity of thinking about what it will be, and in the end, the drawing tells you what you are thinking. And it's trying to work with that same process, even if one's working with actors or musicians, to allow the process of making to be part of the understanding of what the piece is, making of its meaning.
You say that you restlessly pace the studio, and I know that your studio, and you've written about this before, your studio, you've said, is it's chaotic, there's too much stuff in it. Does that hearten you, that you feel that there are a lot of possibilities to pick up on as an artist working in such a space?
I think that you have, one is familiar with the idea of peripheral vision as you're walking around. There are things that at the edge of your vision, which are not what you're focusing on, but which start taking your attention, which are there. And that you physically have in the studio, all the things pinned up on the wall, yesterday's work, photostats, newspaper articles, all of those standard materials in a studio. And one of the things that happens when walking is not only are you seeing these things at the edge of your eye or thinking about how they could connect, but corresponding to that, there's a kind of peripheral thinking, ideas from the edges, which start to inform what you're going to make. And then you discover that the idea you started with, the big idea in the center of the room, is abandoned or is dry, and these tangential ideas start to fill it in. Now, that's both obviously a practical question, that's a description of what happens in the studio. It also has a polemic in it about what it is to be in the periphery, in Johannesburg and not in London, in New York, and to be working at the edges of a tradition rather than the center of a tradition, and allowing those ideas and discovering that, in fact, there are ways of informing this center with all those things that seem outside of it and at the edges.
But we're taught to think that, maybe you were taught to think when you were growing up, that you're on the periphery, being in Johannesburg, being in South Africa rather than in London or New York or Paris or something. Does it feel like the case?
To an extent, it's changed. The art world certainly has changed. There's a way in which curators, collectors, museum people are much more interested in seeing work from outside of London, New York, Paris and Berlin than they were. But if you still look at the list of where artists work in their studios, whose work is shown around the world, A huge number still migrate to Europe, to Berlin. You know, this is the last few years, yeah. Berlin has been the popular city of choice for art. It's not a sense, unless you were there, your work won't be seen, you won't be heard. But if you're an African artist, it's still the case that it's much easier to have your work seen or heard if you take your pots and pans and go to New York or London or Berlin. There's both a sense that the, you know, the diaspora swallows the center, the origin. Many, many shows of art from Africa are really shows of art that used to come from Africa, artists who came from Africa but are living very far from Africa. But I think the periphery is always an interesting place to find new impulses.
I like the idea that that you can make the items in your studio, the things that surround you when you walk down the street, the things that you catch a glimpse of out of the corner of your eye, a bird flying past, a person's bright t-shirt, a shop awning, that these are the things that end up being the ideas that you riff off, paint, turn into films, turn into opera design, turn into all of these things. Well, I wonder if you know you're working when you're walking down the street noticing these things.
No,
there is a bit of the burden of the artist here.
Yeah, right? No, there's not. It's as dumb a walk as anyone's walking through the street, and I have to be kind of hit over the head with an object for it to make its way into a drawing or to be shown what I have been drawing or making. But there are many, I mean, Johannesburg happens to be the city. I mean, there are many things in the city that I realize now are deeply embedded in the work, in questions of animation, of natures, of provisionality, in the question of the informal and the formal and how those fit together, reusing old objects, a city of recycling. Many of those things which are present in any city in the world, but somehow for me are clearer in Johannesburg than they would be if I lived in New York or Amsterdam.
Do you know how things will finish when you start them? I mean, we talk about your impulse to draw, to pace up and down, metaphorically and literally, and you're very active in the films you make as well, of course.
In the studio, there are very often lists. So I think this week, these are the projects I have to work on, and I'll write at the start of the week saying, these are the things I should try to do this week. 3 drawings for Wozzeck, work more on the woodcut sculptures, get the sugar lift etching to the next stage with this print studio. But it's very rare at the end of the week either that I've completed that list, and more importantly, that there aren't a whole new series of projects unanticipated at the beginning of the week that aren't now being done, which will then reappear in the next week's list, which take over, which become exciting, which seem to need to be done. So that shift, that vacillation between trying to pin down what should be done, to be quite ordered in program of work, trying to keep a sense of the shape of what has to be done, but also with an openness for new things to constantly come to the surface.
And I wondered if you can compartmentalize these different jobs that you do as an artist, of the taking a line for a walk, the basic drawings to the opera design and direction, and all of the different things that you do, the films that you make, the interventions you make in books, and the beautiful drawings to the machines that we see downstairs at the Whitechapel as well, the pneumatic sculptures. This might be a common question to ask an artist, but I'd love to know of you about your work. I wonder if you are using a different part of your brain and knowing you are to make these different things.
No, if I could make them all myself, I would be using a different part of the brain. So I will say, I've seen a person who's spinning wool using an old bicycle wheel as a spinning wheel, walking around with a bicycle wheel balanced on her head on a platform. There's the Swazi weavers who spin the wool that is woven into the tapestries here. And on the one hand, you think that's the person walking around with the Marcel Duchamp on her head. And then one thinks, all right, let's make a sculpture of that bicycle wheel on a tripod, and the tripod can grow, and can you turn the bicycle wheel? So I'll do a drawing of there's a bicycle wheel, there's a tripod, maybe there are 2 megaphones and I'd like them to move back. That part I can do. But then I need the people who work in my studio to say, all right, this is bicycle wheel, tripod, 2 megaphones, and I want them to either move up and down or sideways. And they're the geniuses who use a very different part of their brain to work out the mechanics, the making of the gears, the designing of the gears, the chains, the tension, all the things needed to make that happen. But within that, if I'm working on an opera or a drawing a piece, it feels very much the same part of the brain. And many times there'll be a piece of work done, whether it's a fragment of animation or a making of a costume, or which I'm not sure which project it will be used for. It's there as a possibility and finds its home or doesn't, but usually finds its home in one or more projects.
Do things tend to get swept up in a project if they've been kicking about in your studio for
It's all raw material. At the Whitechapel exhibition here, in the piece about Trotsky, O Sentimental Machine.
Yeah.
There are two machines that have a good role in the film. This bicycle wheel, which is kind of a useless machine. It's a mechanical object that has no physical purpose, the Duchamp bicycle wheel. And a beating heart that's really a sewing machine and a megaphone. And those are both objects that existed in the studio that were kind of looking for a use and a home, that we brought into the set of the film and said, well, let's see what they do. And they found their home there. They now appear in the exhibition here as sculptures. But they're both kind of applied sculpture made in the service of something else.
Yeah.
Rather than pure sculptures.
And working with actors and with opera singers and performers and machines that you've made that have come from somewhere that have melded two parts of your imagination or whatever, I wonder who are more rewarding to work with, the machines you make yourself or the...
Well, the machines I don't make myself. My people in my studio make, let's be clear.
Uh-huh.
Or working with the singers. The machines always need someone with them in performance. As objects, they exist as sculptures. So the work with performers, whether they're dancers or singers, is kind of vital. And with that also, obviously, to work with the composer, with the musician, is going to work out what they do. And in the absence of them, having to stick myself in front of the camera to perform different roles and projects. There's nothing better than the hours in the rehearsal room in close proximity to fabulous singers, I mean, whose voices are astonishing. And when you hear it in the confined space of a small rehearsal room, it's completely magical. So that's the best part of opera rehearsal, before it gets on stage.
It's better than it gets on stage.
It's the thing that an audience will never see, because they're looking at... I mean, obviously they get the lights, the projections, the costumes, the whole... But that intimacy of closeness of sound and voice is very, very special.
Is it the same with making art? Is it best when it's just about to leave your studio? Do you
Drawing is always better before it is fixed, before you spray it with fixative. It's more intense, the colors are, the tones are fresher, but it can't, in practical terms, leave the studio unfixed because it just smudges away as it's transported or framed. So there are certain things which are at their richest in the studio, but there's also times when you have the separation and the distance and see it in a cleaned up space of a museum when the drawing or the object or the film comes into its own and is meant for there and is seen in its right form.
And that's a different sort of satisfaction.
It's a very different satisfaction. I mean, there's the satisfaction of something as it develops. The first time you see a new piece of film and as it's edited, how that starts to come together is there's a sense of making in the moment that can be very heady. And then it's a different thing of the much cooler assessment once it's on the walls of a gallery or museum.
And people will at this point be wondering where all this came from. So I'd like to jump back to a bit of your childhood in South Africa. You're an African artist. People might think that should mean that you're a black artist. Your father was an advocate and defended the Biko family and Mandela and Desmond Tutu, I believe, and some key figures. I wonder if you feel you have a responsibility as an artist to take on certain things or whether they are just in your blood.
I think the responsibility of the artist is to work hard and well. And then the work has to take its chances. I mean, to try to instruct what the work ought to be or ought to be about is always a disaster. The bad faith in that impulse shines through. So you have to accept that at a certain point the work will reflect what your interests, your desires, your fears, your loves are, and that in the long term the work is a kind of self-portrait. Whatever its subject, it's going to show who you are. So I don't feel that as a responsibility. You know, there's certain things of South African life that are intensely interesting, and it would be an act of violence to keep them out of the studio, to keep them away. But there are many often are projects which ostensibly are about Europe, Trotsky in Istanbul, Lulu, which is set in Berlin and London and Paris, but which in fact are about questions much closer to home. Some specifically South African, what happens to utopian projects, where do big ideas go wrong in the South African context, and other questions which are not site-specific, the nature of desire and obsession, and the instability of the objects of desire, those questions which come out of the Lulu opera, feel as Johannesburg as any questions.
I wonder if you're interested in the reading of your work by people as well, or whether you have to, as an artist, make it and step back from it, and you check in on it every now and again.
There is a difference in how the work is seen in different countries, in different groups of people. So in India, where there's a much stronger Marxist tradition, say, than in the United States or in Europe, there are far more people reading through different refracted lenses and feeling much closer to the arguments about the nose and Stalin and what happened in the 1930s and Trotsky, where in other places it's seen as an interesting historical artifact. So those things shift. There are projects we did about the Truth Commission, which for some people, say, in Berlin, where they were looking at the Stasi files, felt immediately close, and in Bogota, where there were the questions of how do they deal with their disappearances and their civil war and the FARC and the negotiations with the government, feel something very immediate to those societies. So where the work has an immediate connection, obviously it has a particular strong connection. But there are other ways where people are very connected to the history of image-making and traditions of image-making, where they would approach the work much more from that direction. It has to work on the basis that if it seems to work for me and the collaborators I'm working with, that's the most we can try for, and the hope that other people will connect. And it's interesting sometimes to hear them, and sometimes people's remarks strike a chord, and sometimes they seem very far away from me.
But it doesn't change anything, I suppose, because the work is out there, and it...
No, I'm not thick-skinned in the sense that if people hate or dislike or ignore the work, it's not to say it doesn't become... I mean, artists are so bad at taking criticism. They are the worst people in the world. And I think it's because there's obviously something messed up in artists, something missing, that there's this need that there can never be enough in themselves. It's not like talking to you is enough. I only really believe I exist if I make something outside of myself and see you looking at it and see myself in your look at what is not me, at what that object is. And so if you don't see that, it appears that you don't see me. So kind of the ignoring or the criticism in art can become annihilating. So people are desperately sensitive and oversensitive in a bad way about other people's looking at their work.
And you're in a lot of your work.
I am in a lot of the work.
And I wonder what that... and I know that you were, in the early days you were a performer, yeah, and studied
mime,
and all
actor,
these things come
up. A failed actor. I can look at it and say, oh my God, to anybody looking at this from the outside, this must just be intolerable preening of this prick who's in these films one after another. Give somebody else a chance. Why are we going to look at you anymore? So I think, who is this guy in these films? Not me, that other one. Keep me away from him. We share certain things. We both wear white shirts and black trousers, but otherwise, not me, that's him. So there is a kind of a... Obviously, I have to take responsibility for what I do, but sometimes it also feels quite distant. That's the work, that's not me.
Well, Einstein had a uniform, Chaplin had a uniform, Buster Keaton. We're not a million miles away in your work,
are we?
No,
I suppose that's... I once asked a costume designer who I work with very closely, I said to her, come on, Greta, you must be able to help me. Get me some new clothes. Tell me what I should wear. And she just looked me up and down and said, no, I think what you've got is fine. Even that I failed in. The only time I wear something different is in the Trotsky film, in The Sentimental Machine, where I wear a very beautiful 1930s three-piece suit.
Yes, yeah.
And I kind of think maybe that's what I should start wearing, but it weighs a ton and it's hot as hell.
in starring in your work, in performing in your work, in making the work in front of the camera, the zoetrope, whatever the techniques that you've used for those films are, whether you, the performance of being the artist is obviously a thought away from sitting in your studio without a camera running, without
with subconsciously drawing, but are those two different things?
They are. I mean, a lot of the films, of the short films, me climbing over the chair and things like that, are demonstrations of an idea for a lecture. So a lot of those short films start as, instead of just a slide in a lecture, but a demonstration of a process. And then some of them expand into short films in their own right or get turned into drawings that that look at that. But I suppose the form of the lecture as performance rather than just as a read, written text is something that I'm very involved with at the moment, working on different lecture performances.
And the lecture performances are an interesting thing because you're so good at talking about your work, but I wonder if that's, does that help make an understanding of it for you? I mean, I wonder if that's the finishing of it when you're talking about it.
No, I mean, the lectures have to come after the work.
Yeah.
There can be a technique that's demonstrated in a lecture, but they can't really take the place of the work. And a lot of them are about the nature of what it is to make a single line of coherence of a lecture as opposed to the multiple strands of incoherence we live with, from which we construct a possible coherence of ourselves and the world as if that's who we might be. So that provisionality and that agency of making, which one has in the studio making a drawing, or in this case, in the activity of trying to construct the single argument of a lecture, have echoes. There's a lot of words that come into the drawings that are more or less nonsensical. They're phrases, they're abstruse phrases that hover at the edge of meaning.
And they're quite technical, and some of them are political
or technical, and find the less good idea. Quite what would that mean? History on one leg, struggle for the good heart. So some of them are in the form of slogans, other of aide memoirs, some chapter headings. Trying to gather words which are halfway between being read and looked at as a drawing to allow ideas to see if there are ideas waiting to coalesce. And very often there are just these phrases and nothing in between them, and they hang there. And one has to accept that's as far as I can take them.
And there's a lot of nice books for sale downstairs here at Whitechapel. There is a lot of words. There are more words in your monographs than there are pictures a lot of the time. Well, I've got this book here, The Six Drawing Lessons, which is a beautiful one.
It's a beautiful book, and it was specifically the way I really love that book, because it's a reading book, not a picture book.
Yeah.
I mean, for artists, the first books you have are all picture books, and this feels like the first adult book.
Okay.
There are minimal pictures. Minimal pictures. There are illustrations, but it's not essentially illustrations with the text to go with it.
And I wonder why that is. I mean, is that because I don't know whether you have an urge to explain. I mean, we're talking today. It feels good to be talking about this.
No, I write with great difficulty. I mean, when I did the six drawing lessons, which I knew would turn into a book, the six lectures that I gave, I had to make a rule. No drawing till after lunch. Because the default position, it's so much easier to draw than to write. I would always find a drawing that needed to be done instead of doing the writing. So there's a kind of an enforced discipline of having to get those words out. And then there was a pleasure in itself of playing with what it was too. It felt like playing at being a writer. Okay. The actor today, the role he's playing is the writer, sitting at a table with your pen and writing it out longhand.
And is that what you do? How do you feel when you're doing that? Do you sit up straighter? Are you in the corner of the room looking down on yourself like an out-of-body experience?
No, I'm walking around. The first hour is walking around, trying to say the first sentence in my head to myself. This is what the first thing will be. And then I say, you know what? I'm never going to get to the first sentence. I'm going to start in the middle and just let the rubbish come out and halfway through, and it's true, and very soon in the second or third paragraph, you find, oh, okay, this is what I really wanted to say, and it starts getting written down. And then you have to go back and rescue the first page or two pages.
Because there's a lot of ideas of narrative in your work as well, and that is a funny one, to be starting in the middle.
Start in the middle and work out. I mean, the films I make, the animated films, are all made without a script or a storyboard, on the basis that any script or story that I write, you know, is going to be wrong. It's not going to be bad. It's not worth making. It's not worth reading. So the only hope is that one starts from an image or an impulse and allows that to grow forwards and backwards, which film is very good for because it is fragmentary and constructed through editing. And the form of filmmaking has always been, or the technique of filmmaking, of shooting things out of sequence, seeing what happens if you change the order of images, which you, and you can write that way, but that's less common to write a novel in the way you would write a, you would edit a film.
And I wonder, maybe we can end by going back to your studio, William. And I know you've got a lot of, you work with a lot of people to make certain pieces, of course, the technical, the structural, the pneumatic pieces. Are you good at working with people? I wonder if you're good at sharing the love, you know?
Well, I have two studios. I have a studio in the garden where the drawings are made and the animation is done. And next to that is an office where all the people who work to support the emails and travel and photographs and archives are. And then there's a studio in the center of Johannesburg, which is larger and noisier, where the sculpture is made, where we would do theatrical rehearsals, where we would do filming if there's more people needed. And that separation is good. In the studio, if I'm drawing, I need to be alone in the studio. It doesn't work to have other people wandering around. So the nights and weekends are great for actual drawing. And in the other one, it's very good to have all the people working on them, all the people, the two people working on making the sculptures and objects. And that conversation, not just them physically making, but the conversations that come out of that. And the same as working with print studios and weaving studios, which are not my studios, but which I collaborate with.
So maybe in one you feel like you're going to work, and the other one you feel like you're at play, maybe?
No, they all feel like I'm at play. I mean, it's sometimes it does feel ridiculous that this is an adult activity. It's a bit like James Thurber, who wrote about trying to work out what his maid thought about him staying at home and writing or drawing every day. And he realized that she thought he was well enough to be let out of the asylum, but not yet well enough to go to work.
So he stuck at it. He stuck at the play.
He stuck at the play.
It worked out.
Yeah.
And you mentioned nights and weekends being a good time to draw. Is that, are you an inspiration merchant? Are you scribbling things down at 4 in the morning? And are you quite routine?
I'm not someone who works at 4 in the morning. I'm someone who has insomnia at 4 in the morning every night. And I'll occasionally read. Usually I'll just lie and fret until sleep comes back. And I'm much better at working earlier in the morning than at 2 in the morning. I mean, at 10 in the morning or 9 or 8 is much better for me than 2 in the morning, just temperamentally. I have lots of notebooks with phrases in them, and half the time I can't remember what that phrase referred to or what it was meant to. And sometimes I can't physically read my handwriting, and that's often when some of the best misunderstandings happen that are very productive.
So there is a sort of secret to this stuff, that it's a bolt of lightning somehow.
Well, an F becomes an S. Well, where did that come from? And then I realized I've just misread what I'd written, but what I'd misread was much more useful than the correct reading.
We're back to the peripheral vision.
It is the peripheral vision and the productivity of misunderstanding and mistranslation, where you're aware of the work you're doing in filling in unknown areas, of your brain being forced to make possible leaps from one thing to another.
It sounds like the job of an artist.
I think it is the job of an artist.
William Kentridge, thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Robert Bounds, in conversation with William Kentridge. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Lutie, researched by Gaia Lutz, and edited by Claire Crofton. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any other of our programmes on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, and of course, monocle.com. Until next time, all that's left to say is thanks for tuning in.